Hello and welcome to the Sound Barrier podcast from Silent London. The Sound Barrier podcast is released fortnightly and each episode discusses two films, a new release and a classic from the silent era that complements or matches it in some way. To find out more, visit silentlondon.co.uk or search for Silent London on iTunes or Stitcher. The Sound Barrier is hosted by me, Pamela Hutchinson. I'm the editor of Silent London. And Peter Barron?
That's me.
And today we have a special guest in the studio, Ewan Munro, who blogs about film at filmcentric.wordpress.com.
Hello. Very infrequently at that, and amateurishly.
It's quality over quantity. So let's begin with the films. The new release film we're talking about today is Lady Macbeth. William Oldroyd's debut feature film was made on a tiny £350,000 budget, which is vastly unusual, not to say unprecedented, for a period film. A stripped-back, taut adaptation of Nikolai Leskov's novella Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, Oldroyd's film is set in the north of England sometime in the 19th century and brings more than a shade of Wuthering Heights or the psychosexual angst of Thomas Hardy to the source material. Florence Pugh delivers a tremendous performance as Catherine, a young woman married off to an older landowner, living with him and his gruff father in an isolated house on the moors. The marriage, like Catherine's daily life, is loveless, sexless, and stifling. The men insist that she stay indoors at all times, whereas she longs to breathe the fresh air. When the two men leave her alone in the house for a few days, she wanders as far as the stables, where she meets Sebastian, a groom. They begin an affair, which seems to awaken not just the sexual impulse in Catherine, but also a desire to become mistress of the house, even if she has to kill to get what she wants. Alice Birch's crisp screenplay, perhaps partly due to the financial constraints on the shoot also, cuts away the paranormal visions that haunt the novella. The horror here is more tangible, from bone-crunching noise effects and gobbets of blood to the sound of an old man dying like a panicked dog on the other side of a door. What has been filtered into the story, though, is a racial dynamic. Catherine and her in-laws are white, while Sebastian, played by Cosmo Jarvis, is not. And Naomi Aki plays Anna, the housemaid who bears the brunt of both Catherine and her father-in-law's cruelty, and she's black too, as are two late-arriving characters who pose a threat to Catherine's bloody reign as Lady of the Manor. Lady Macbeth is an astonishingly accomplished film, a taut and brutal period thriller which both exceeds the expectations set by its micro-budget and promises great things to come from its director and star.
Which we are pairing with Victor Sostrom's 1928 movie, The Wind, where we find Lillian Gish playing Letty, a young woman from Virginia travelling to the West to live with her cousin Beverly. He's a male cousin, which is a source of some tension down the line. The train travels through some howling wind and Letty strikes up a friendship with Wirtz, played by the deliciously named Montague Love, who warns her about how difficult life on the plains are. When they get to Sweetwater, Wirtz promises to visit her, but in the meantime Letty's picked up by Liege Hightower, played by Lars Hansen, and the older Sourdough, played by William Ormolond, who are clearly captivated by Letty as they deliver her to her cousin Beverly and his jealous wife. At this point, the film develops along two themes. Beverly's wife wants Letty out of the house, so pushes her to get married, and there are already three aforementioned suitors, Sourdough, Liege and Wirt. At the same time, Letty is faced with the elements, and in particular the titular wind, which is omnipresent from a howling cyclone to the constant barrage of propeller-created gusts. Sostrom creates a film with very little in the way of stylistic flourishes. He trusts his camera, his Mojave Desert locations, and in particular his leading lady, with whom he'd already worked on The Scarlet Letter. This is very much a Gish-led film. She suggested adapting the original Dorothy Scarborough novel to Irving Folberg, and appointed Sostrom to direct. Despite being a hard-hitting female-led film, it still has to elide a number of plot developments from the book. The book contains a rape, which the film swaps out for a fade-out in the bedroom, but it is nevertheless particularly strong on using nature in conjunction with Gish's acting to suggest her state of mind. Nevertheless, the film deviates from the book's original ending with notable effect. The Wind had a critically mixed reception at the time. Mordenhall panned it, and released during the transition to sound, it wasn't a huge hit in the US, though it did better in Europe. Since then, it's gained a strong critical following, combining one of the most iconic silent female leads with one of its more unsung but terrific directors in Sostrom.
My father bought Hugh, along with a piece of land not fit enough for a cow to graze upon. You will remain here, indoors, with your prayer book.
I understand you've been taking the air lately.
Mrs. Lester!
It's just restless if she's tied up too long.
She was, sir.
Was what?
tied up too long.
So the reason that we put these two films together, it's slightly hard to articulate in a snappy phrase, but we both sort of came up with the idea together because sort of visually, in a way, we see a woman in a house, isolated, and we see sex and violence. We see a lot of violence in the future for both these women. So our theme is women in the wilderness, women in the wild.
Women alone in women the wild, alone. Yeah.
Solitary women in flat countries. What do you reckon, Ewan?
That makes perfect sense. Also, there's definitely an element of masculine, controlling, domineering kind of nature going on there, I think, with their situations, yeah, respectively.
And on this podcast, which they
attempt. Yes, which they attempt. Yeah, indeed. Well, that's why I'm here now. So to give that extra male voice that's so sorely needed in the world of podcasting. I mean, but both these films were written by women, of course.
Certainly. I mean, I think that these films portray men who are controlling and domineering, but I don't think that that's in any way condoned. I mean, I would slightly disagree with you, Pete, when you say that the rape is kind of eluded from the wind. I think that it's quite clear that it's happened just because it's not seen.
Yeah, I agree, but it's about what they will present and what they won't present, I think. I mean, yeah, and I think it's relatively clear that it happens. I think audiences at the time, if they wanted to, could have suggested it didn't happen, and I think...
So we've got Dorothy Scarborough wrote the novel for The Wind, and then Frances Marion, I think, adapted it for the screen.
That's right.
And in the case of Lady Macbeth, it's Nikolai Leskov. And also, there's another text here you guys might be familiar with called Macbeth by someone called William Shakespeare.
There's a Scottish play, though.
And then that was adapted by Alice Birch for the film. So, yeah, I think we do have quite strong female voices on film here in many, many ways.
And the leads, of course. The lead actresses in both cases, I think, are driving an awful lot of what's going on.
And I think you did a really nice job of discussing how much Lillian Gish was sort of in control and kind of producer role. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why we feel like these films go together. And maybe by the time I publish this podcast, we'll have a snappy phrase for it.
I mean, I think it's pretty obvious from the posters.
And shout out to Pete and his beautiful artwork. He will mash up any poster you like. Now, the second thing, and while I go to Ewan for this particularly, is just a kind of first impression. What did you think of the two films?
Well, I don't know. Is this too early for me to say? This was my first time ever watching The Wind. It's a silent classic. It's been on many best ever lists, and somehow I managed to get through half my life without having ever seen it, and I thought it was fantastic. I went back and watched it again, in fact, a few days later, just so I could get more of it that I felt that I maybe didn't the first time. So I loved it. Lady Macbeth grew on me. I mean, when I first saw it, I was not sure that I liked it exactly. I was not sure I liked her, certainly about halfway through the film. There's at
you
least
don't
a
need
point
to
where,
like.
But yes, you're right. Actually, when I kept thinking about it over the coming days after I saw it, I realized maybe that's the point. Maybe I didn't have to like her, and maybe it was fine for me not to like her, and maybe it's right for me, especially as a man, not to like her, and yet think she was a very strong character and an excellent character and well portrayed by Florence Pugh, who I'd seen in The Falling when that came out and was excellent, but she had a small role in that, and here she really showed that she could carry a film.
Well, I mean, like you, and this was my first time watching The Wind all the way to the end. I had seen part of it, which there is absolutely no excuse for. I also am slightly at a disadvantage with you guys because I watched Lady Macbeth a few months ago, literally months ago.
Oh, the terror of having to see previews.
The London Film Festival?
No,
it
was actually after the London Film Festival. Right. I remember I was going to go and watch it at the London Film Festival because this film caught my eye. I really want to see it. And I sort of had a bit of a word with myself and said, no, go and do some work. Don't just muck about watching films. And so I didn't see it at the London Film Festival, but I subsequently went to see it at a preview screening in November. And I've sort of been running around telling everyone since how much I liked it. But, you know, I haven't seen it since then. And yeah, so I think they're both kind of five-star films for me. I think they're great movies.
I would agree. They're terrific. I mean, I think Lady Macbeth, I only saw yesterday, so I'm still...
So hot.
Still processing a little bit, and I think there are sort of issues around it which are fascinating. I think the lead performance is incredible, and I think William Oldroyd as directing does some very clever things with a small amount of money, which I'm sure we're going to come on to. Yeah, I think we'll come on to some of my issues with it, but those issues are not things that make it a worse film. It makes it linger more in the mind in some ways.
Well, I think they're both films particularly that do that. They linger. There's lots to discuss. So we tried to narrow down our categories. We've got six categories. I appear to have written down five. We've got six categories.
There are six.
We've got six categories to discuss, and we'll start with the one you can't really avoid. We're going to talk about the women at the heart of these films. We're going to talk about Catherine and Letty. We're going to talk about Florence Pugh and Lillian Gish. Who'd like to start?
Can I talk about Gish?
You may talk about Gish.
Can I gush over Gish?
You get your Gish wish.
Yeah. I mean, Lillian Gish in outside of her iconic status at the time anyway, as one of the most famous leading ladies in the world, was very, very good at portraying these delicate flower characters in some ways, in some films. Mm. And it's interesting here that is what she's using. She's using that persona. But the film is a lot more hard-hitting around what that means in a realistic situation. She's moving from Virginia to stay with her cousin. She's clearly moving for financial reasons. Mm-hmm. Doesn't really know what to expect, but doesn't really have a choice. And is the woman at the centre of... Basically, the minute any man meets her, they fall in love with her. And she doesn't...
Is this because she's so beautiful? And obviously, Lillian Gish is very beautiful, and she's a beautiful young woman in this film. Or is this because she's a new woman in a small town?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a certain practical element there.
Absolutely. I think there's a degree of rationing going on. Yeah. I think yeah, absolutely. And everyone... But also, because they're in a small town, everyone kind of thinks they've got a chance as well. Mm-hmm. So from Sourdough, the older... fella.
And your Lady Macbeth put me off age gap relationships.
Indeed, yes. And then there's Liege, who is much younger and potentially looks like a romantic lead.
Lars Hansen, indeed. Like Lars Hansen.
He's an attractive man.
But what about Montague Love? Montague Love is very garrulous to start off with. He seems like an all right bit of stuff.
Well, he looks like a cad, is what he looks like. And he acts like...
We watched The Wind together, and we sort of, you more or less want to sort of hiss when he comes on screen, when he starts being very forward to her in the train carriage with his banana.
Yes,
he does. And if anybody would like to explain symbolism to us, we'll make something of that banana, but I honestly can't think what it would mean.
I see you haven't included symbolism as a category, no. Possibly for good reason.
Indeed. So I think as the film develops, what the film asks Lillian Gish to do is act a decaying mental state. Things happen to her, which certainly contribute to that, but there is, in the end, the underpinning wind, which is supposedly going to drive her mad. She has to show that, does a really good job at that. I mean, the film is good at giving us those bits, but in the end, it's a silent film. We can't hear this wind, and that's one of the things about wind. And one of the things they say about the wind is it's ever present. So even when she's indoors, you hear the wind. And the film is really good at suggesting that, but she is really good at suggesting that as well. So there are a couple of bits where she has to change her view on individuals, and she does change her view, and that just seems so natural. And you know, I think her performance is terrific in this, and I've not seen anything where she's been particularly bad, but this I think really stands out to me as...
I've not seen Lillian Gish be bad, but she doesn't often get such a fascinating character. And, you know, I think that her particular mannerisms and the waif thing work really well. I think I was going to bring you in on this, Ewan, but I think that with both actresses and both roles, there's a sort of tension between frailty and strength. You know, they look immediately, we have, you know, the world's most famous waif, and then we have Florence Pugh, who's very young, and we see her first with her wedding veil on, suggests a kind of innocence and, you know, and yeah, that kind of frailty. But that's not how the film unfolds. Could you talk a little bit about Florence Pugh?
Florence Pugh is excellent in Lady Macbeth. In fact, to the extent that I barely even remember anyone else in that film, although I do. But she has, like, in many ways, like Lillian Gish, has the most expressive eyes in this film that sort of glare through... that burn through the screen even and take in the viewer. She uses them sort of as a weapon to the extent that her husband disappears for much of the film, maybe to escape the way that she sort of wields her what little power she has, but it's a very expressive face, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of said, you know, there's a lot of controlling male behaviour in that film, but actually she causes a lot of disruption. She causes them to lash out. You wonder whether there's a certain motivation for them to get out the way because, you know, her marital relations are not what you would wish for.
Not what she would wish for.
Not
either.
What anyone would wish for. They're sort of perverse and joyless.
Yes. Yeah. No, they can't be pleasant for her to go through.
I mean, she must be freezing.
Well, it's suggested many times at the beginning, you must be freezing. And she says she isn't. She likes it cold.
Yeah, because she's got cold blood, absolutely.
But, I mean, I think one thing that's interesting about both these performances, or to contrast with both these performances, is that Lillian Gish is playing a relatively, a contemporary character to her, or relatively contemporary. If it's set in the past, it's recent. Florence Pugh is playing someone from the 19th century, my sense is here. But the film is toying with a modern sensibility as well. I mean, we do feel a large degree of sympathy towards her character for at least half of the film.
Yes.
Because of patriarchy and, you know, her position.
Oh, there's that. But I think the acting style is very much in a naturalistic vein that maybe if we think of recent period films like A Quiet Passion, which completely goes the other direction in terms of the past is almost impossible to imagine different, distant place. Whereas this, it has the rawness of, say, Wuthering Heights by Andrea Arnold, that kind of constant feeling of passion and wildness.
On almost... Well, many recent adaptations of Wuthering Heights. One of the things, can I just talk about something that really annoys me?
Go on.
And it's not something that either of you have done or would do, but I've seen a lot of reviews and capsule reviews of Lady Macbeth that talk about, you know, a period film that doesn't feel like a period film, and it's a period film that's good. And there's some sort of idea in criticism at the moment that if people are wearing corsets, then everything they do is going to be really dull. And what they really mean, even though they don't say it, is... if people are women, everything they're going to do. So period films quite often do focus on female characters. And here, I mean, she's called Lady Macbeth. We know that this is going to... Somehow there's something like, if there's violence, it's somehow better. Now, I mean, I think the violence in Lady Macbeth is completely psychologically true and feels earned. But yeah, I just thought I'd have a little mini rant.
No, feel free. You're right.
It's a well-deserved rant. There's nothing wrong with a good period film, in my opinion. And, you know, I don't care what it's about. Like Alan Rickman's film about gardening, that was an excellent period film. I'm sorry.
A little chaos.
But what about Belle, you know, which I think is really interesting when we think about the casting in this film, particularly. Yeah. And, you know, it's almost as if people had brains and issues in the past. Parts and genitals as well.
But they didn't have the internet. How could they have brains?
Who knows? They didn't have podcasts to give their opinions on things.
Had a lot more time to do some reading, as we discovered in A Quiet Passion.
Absolutely. And writing. Gosh, you know, we would all be poets if this was the 19th century. Do you know that?
Yes.
We might be novelists. One of the things I think is interesting when we compare these two performances, and, you know, I'm always about trying to find points of comparison between the two films, but in this case we do have Florence Pugh, who's a relatively new actress, and wonderful name, Florence Pugh. Brilliant name.
Wonderful.
And Lillian Gish, who was... you could say she was sort of at the height of her powers, but, you know, if you read what Louise Brooks has to say, MGM was sort of a little bit wary of her, and, you know, with the silent era coming to a close, you know, she's on the cusp of disappearing, really.
Yeah.
So you've got, like, a massive star versus the debut. Do you think it's possible to compare those kind of performances?
No. I think
Go ahead and do it.
I think you can. What you're getting is, of course, is baggage, okay? So with Lillian Gish, she comes with a lot of baggage and uses that to her advantage. With Florence Pugh, she comes with no baggage at all and uses that to her advantage. We don't know what this character is going to be and how this character is going to act when we see her. So she has 5 to 10 minutes to tell us that, whereas Lillian Gish can relax from the opening and know that we know that she is the heroine, and we know that, you know, as we go through, you know, there is a sense in both of these films that after about 20 minutes, you kind of know where they're going, and then they both go... get there in quite weird ways.
I feel like there's at least a hint as to where it's going when the title Lady Macbeth.
As to
what perhaps she's capable of. But as an actor, obviously you don't.
And you want to be true to how the character would appear in those first scenes. Like, that Catherine's character is not that she was kicking and screaming at the chapel. You know, she basically arrives and she sees the lay of the land quite early on. I think that visually, we might talk about this later, the film lets us know that she arrives in the manor house, as it were, and says, I'm going to get this.
She knows her place. In as much as she knows what's expected of her when she gets there, when she's in this arranged marriage. And when she doesn't get what she expects, pretty much on the first night, then everything else is up in the air a bit. It's like, okay, well, I'm not going to get it that way. How am I going to get it?
Yeah, exactly.
Can I go back to Ewan's point and actually go... my little rant, similar
rant.
You all
have a rant. You've got to save one.
I don't feel a rant in me, but we'll see how.
Which is about Lady Macbeth and Lady Macbeth from that play. What Pamela suggested earlier. Lady Macbeth, of course, doesn't kill anyone. All Lady Macbeth does in Macbeth is say to her husband, "You might want to think about this."
But for a female character, that's as monstrous as doing
of course.
The
but I think that's something that. Whereas in Lady Macbeth of the movie, she does do all of the murders.
Yeah, there is murdering that will happen in this film. And, you know, other people might be tempted to murder as well. Other people are violent. You know, she's living in quite a violent world.
Yeah.
One of my favourite scenes in Lady Macbeth, I just found it a really rich and sort of unexpected scene, is a moment when Sebastian toys with killing someone or thinks about killing someone or the possibility of it. And you wonder, like, how far her, you know, her Lady Macbeth type poison will spread. And will her Macbeth actually, you know, screw his courage to the sticking point, etc., etc.?
I don't think he does he?
No, he does not. He does not, because there's only one murderer in this town. I was reading, And I think it's really fascinating to read about the making of Lady Macbeth because the budget was so small. I mean, I know £350,000 is a lot to all of us, but apparently it was a 24-day shoot, or they planned it as a 24-day shoot. Mm. Everyone's working for equity minimum. And as you see, if you watch the film, there are very few special effects, really, just sort of gore, really.
Well, and there are very few exteriors.
When we think about these films, we don't think so much about the houses and modern trappings, whatever the, you know, what's modern in the 19th century, that kind of trapping. We think about women as sort of dots on the landscape, as it were, and women in the air. I'm going to come up with a theme for this podcast.
I think we've got a theme. I mean, the similarity is around these two lead women, and we should probably score them.
Yeah, I think we should score them, and I really don't want to, because I really don't want to draw a line, but I'm just going to be polite and say guest first, Ewan.
Well, I don't think our judgment on this will affect either of their careers, for obvious reasons in one case, but I would have to say the Lillian Gish in The Wind. Florence Pugh is amazing, and I love her in this film. She's great, but it's The Wind. It's one of the greatest films ever.
I'm equally going to go for Gish for a slightly different reason, which is the classic reason why people don't win their Oscar on their first go round. She's going to have loads of opportunities to win this in the future, so I'm going to give it to Lillian. I absolutely agree. Both terrific performances.
I mean, absolutely bloody brilliant performances. Love Florence Pugh. I hope that she won't sit there and say, well, you know, my career was going great, but then the people on the Sound Barrier podcast said that I wasn't as good as Lillian Gish, because I would feel guilty. She seems like a really nice young woman. I mean, we should also mention, and we'll get onto this character, but Naomi Ackie in Lady Macbeth is absolutely terrific as well. I'm going to give this to The Wind. I'm going to give it to Lillian Gish, partly because Lillian Gish, it feels like no one else could have played that role like her.
Absolutely.
And with Florence Pugh, maybe, maybe not.
Yeah.
So let's get a little bit more thematic. We're going to talk about nature, about wind, we're going to talk about horses, we're going to talk about moors and glaring skies. Mm. Well, both these films are basically about the elements.
I mean, in a film that's called The Wind, I mean, obviously nature is going to take a large role in that. There's a hint that it's, or a suggestion that perhaps is an allegorizing sexuality or her own sexuality. And I'm on the fence about that. I mean, she's certainly...
The wind will knock you off that fence.
Yeah, well, indeed it will. I mean, she has a sort of a overt sexual effect on everyone, and we've talked about that, the way that all these men, including her cousin, come onto her. I feel like The Wind is more... It is more about the forces of nature, and I think Lillian Gish in this film has a frailty to her that is, in a way, suggestive of how humanity is in confronting the forces of nature out here on the frontier, where humans are weak and nature is so big and domineering. I mean, from the very prologue, which it says, man, puny but irresistible, encroaching forever on nature's fortresses, that's the very first text that we see. And so it's right there that this is a film about how puny humans are.
But you could also read that, you could substitute the word women for nature. We're quite familiar with the idea of things like wind and horses, and let's not forget that the wind in The Wind is referred to as a wild horse and shown visually as
wild horses.
Yeah, in a very kind of phantom carriage, kind of moody superimposition effect. That's pretty much a cliche now. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, in Lady Macbeth, all she has to do is sit on the window and open the window, and you think, because she wants some fresh air. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and you immediately think, you know, this is what we associate female sexuality and a kind of, you know, forces of onrushing wind and things like that. Was it a cliche in The Wind?
I don't think it is. I think also there's something else that needs to be considered with The Wind. Again, the time it was filmed, so 1928, we're looking at the encroaching Dust Bowl. Mm-hmm. And the film is suggesting something about that. So they, you know, the promise of the West, freedom, you know, a space of your own, is now being challenged by the fact that those spaces are being destroyed and are no longer fertile, if we want to bring sexuality back up again. So, and the shortage of women would do that too. So I think it isn't a cliche. The bits that have become cliche have essentially come up because of some of the visual imagery in this film. I mean, the Guinness advert that springs to mind with the horses in the storm is nicking it from here, really. Sorry.
I think it's Glazer. Used in a very restrained way here. It's only, if I recall correctly, the sort of lap dissolve to the horse sort of whinnying
once or
and
twice,
only happens a couple of times.
And they always talk about the wind. They give it a name. They call it the Norther. Whereas these things are completely unspoken in Lady Macbeth. But you do have, in a film that has no score, you do have these sounds of the wind, and what you have is a kind of very modern effect, because you have the sound not of wind, but of how wind buffets against a microphone.
Yeah. There are a few twangs of a score in there. There isn't a score per se, but there are undertones that bring up some sensations, but it is generally scoreless.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All the sound effects sort of come to the fore, don't they?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. Now, we saw it last week with a pretty ropey...
Yeah, I mean, it was fair score. We watched The Wind on a French DVD, if you know the one I mean. You watched it on a Spanish DVD, which might be the same release, actually.
It's certainly not a very good print either. It demands... I'd love to see a scrubbed-up copy on the big screen, because I think it's a beautiful film that's not really given its best dues on those...
I suppose my point was kind of around the accompaniment, though, and that, you know, when I saw it, first time I saw it was at the Bird's Eye Film Festival.
At an award-winning screening.
What award did it win, Pam? Yeah, it won an award on Silent London for the best original score. And I think there's a lot you can do with the score here, which, and the film gives you that, you know. But even if, I mean, one thing I wanted to do and didn't quite get around to doing is just listen to it with the sound of wind, because there's lots of wind out there on the YouTubes now.
Really? Yeah, you can listen to wind on the YouTubes.
Get you to go to sleep.
Yeah, that works for me.
Although I feel like the kind of wind in the film is not the kind of wind that would keep you, you
can get that wind as well. And so, just listening to it with that as a soundtrack. I mean, it's a film, I think, that will stand up quite well on its own without a score anyway.
Oh, yes. No, I mean, the DVD that I watched it on had such a sort of iffy score on it that I ended up just whacking on some music instead to give it the appropriate...
What did you try?
Some Scott Walker, late period, dark and brooding.
Not Childhood of a Leader.
Yes, that and his one with the Sun, the... doom metal band called Soused. It's a great piece of work, but it's troubling if you lay up late at night listening to it, I would say. Or watching it with the wind, which it turns out, for all it never seems comic, and maybe it's not just because of what I put on when I was watching it, but it's always got this undertow of threat and danger to it.
And I think as a film that is melodrama in a lot of ways, which can often tip into particularly old melodrama, tip into humour, it never does that. I think it's
characters
sincere.
Smile, but they don't smile out of happiness. Yeah. When she marries, she is very notably not smiling while he is trying to get it on with her.
Like, let's play a game of speedy plot synopses. Mm. If you talk about The Wind, it's about a woman who moves to where the wind is terrified of the wind and learns to embrace the wind.
Yes.
Right, okay, so she learns to embrace it, and what we mean is sex. But in Lady Macbeth, we don't have anyone kind of trying to embrace nature. Lady Macbeth is being controlled, and then she tries to impose her control on the world.
Right.
So I think, you know, it's quite interesting that we use a lot of the same similar imagery, if we can call the wind imagery, but actually we're proceeding in a very different direction. You know, there are horses. There's a real horse in Lady Macbeth, and that doesn't end well for
it doesn't end well for anyone.
The horse in Lady Macbeth and the unfortunate chap in The Wind have something in common. You
later.
Know, yeah, we're going to talk about suspense later, I think. This is a difficult one to score, just because which of these films made you think more interestingly about nature, I suppose? So, peace.
I'm going to go against type here. I think I'm actually going to say I'll give this to Lady Macbeth, because I think what's interesting about Lady Macbeth's use of nature is that nature represents freedom for her, and represents, you know, Sebastian, her lover, is also of nature. Mm-hmm. And I think it is something that the film doesn't have to do. It's not in the text, and so therefore it uses it in a clever way.
I am going to go once again for The Wind.
Like this movie.
I love this movie.
I really
love this movie, and I'm so surprised. I'm not surprised. I shouldn't be surprised, but I loved it. Yeah, no, I'm going to go for The Wind. I think it's a film about... I know you were saying that Lady Macbeth tries to sort of control and sort of repress nature a bit, or tries to have one up on it, but I think they're both films where they try and fight back against nature to a certain futile extent, and I feel that they're both about that sort of feeling. In both cases, they end up being sort of destroyed by it in a sense, although we'll get onto the endings later. But I love The Wind, and I would vote for The Wind on this count.
I completely agree with you that you know, The Wind is also about kind of having a conflict with nature, trying to control nature. That Lady Macbeth just edges this one for me, because I feel that they take that idea and they move further forward with it. And I know that there is a 90-year gap.
Sit back down.
Oh, no,
sit down.
Through hell and high water, I will follow you.
Sebastian!
To the cross. To the
prison. She's a disease.
To the grave, to the sky.
She's so fucking me.
These films are both kind of about isolation and isolated figures, and that was one of the things that first drew us to pairing these two films together.
Well, I mean, there's plenty of isolation in both films, isn't there? I mean, they're both films that feel like they're set on the edges of civilization. I guess in the case of Lady Macbeth, that's not literally true. It's Northumberland, but
Northumberland.
I was born in Scotland, so it's the far south. Yeah, no, it feels like a rugged area on the edge of civilization, and so does the wind. The wind, literally, it's the western front, and it is that mythic territory of where, you know, men are men and women keep the home and legends are forged with their bare hands and all this kind of the classic tropes. But it doesn't go quite where you expect. Both of them, for all their setting out there, they're very interior films. I think they're more about these two characters and being trapped and trying to fight against that. To me,
I think there's an interesting about how the isolation is portrayed and also how it comes about in both films, because Letty in The Wind isn't strictly isolated. Obviously, she's got her cousin, she's got her cousin's wife, she's got her husband, the many children. She ends up being isolated because of a breakdown in the relationship between her and her cousin's wife. So it's forced upon her. Equally, Catherine and Lady Macbeth, whilst isolated in a different kind of way, there are plenty of films, in fact, you know, where, or plenty of tales where she would have become a lot closer to her quite early on, but it never really happens.
And she distances herself from Anna in quite, I mean, I think that's one of the most breathtaking things. There is violence in this film, but the way that she shows absolutely no solidarity, in fact, the opposite with Anna, is absolutely
horrific.
Shocking, yeah.
Unfortunately, Anna is saddled with one of the less good tropes of, let's say, Russian novelists might put on someone, making someone go mute for no obvious reason, but she wasn't, well, for mainly plot development reasons, one would suggest, but
and so it will make us think of The Wind when we watch it.
Indeed, yes. So they don't need to be quite as isolated as they are, and Letty is only really isolated when her husband goes off.
I sort of feel that both films show women isolated, but they use the physical isolation of the remote location to whittle down their social group. So each of them, they're isolated in that they appear to be basically the sole woman in a household of men, or a group of men. You know, there are all those sort of ranchers in The Wind, and there's the husband and father-in-law in the house in Lady Macbeth, who are both utterly vile.
Terrible.
The father-in-law is just terrible. I would have drunk all his wine. When the husband comes home, the way he talks to her, that's again one of the most violent pieces. And then in each case, as you completely rightly pointed out, there's another woman that sort of contrasts. So, you know, the fact that Letty does not find a friend in her cousin's wife. The cousin's wife sees Letty as a rival, and I think that Catherine sees Anna as some kind of rival. She's not about to make friends with her. She really has a solitary purpose in mind. And so, in a way, they're about women who... It's about showing how women can be isolated even when they aren't.
Yeah.
If you look at the publicity stills for both these films, they have very good publicity stills, particularly The Wind. You know, you just have mostly just have the women by themselves. Even I was looking at the publicity stills, this is kind of part of my job, for Lady Macbeth. And, you know, even there are a couple of the publicity stills that show the wedding scene. And in both cases, as you see in the film, you just see the bride. You know, that's one with some people in the background. But, you know, it's really about, it's doing something that films quite often don't do, and we talk about it quite a lot, that they don't do it. They don't focus on the female characters. Mm. They don't focus on the wife. The amount of times I have spent trying to sympathise or take interest in female characters in films only to realise I'm never going to see them again.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen in either of these films. So in a way, the isolation becomes a kind of power because they become the star of their own story. I don't know how you can score isolation.
Well, you could use Joy Division, but...
Oh dear.
Were you going to say who is the most isolated? I mean, you know, or
which gets it across best, or that quality of isolation best? For me, I'm going to go with Lady Macbeth on this one. I know I've been voting for The Wind, and this isn't just a sympathy vote. I really do love
is
the
this
way
tactical?
That I don't play those games. No, I just love the way that it got across its sense of isolation and with relatively small means at its disposal, as we've talked about with the budget. It's a film that really gives me a sense of what it must be like to to be trapped in a house with terrible, terrible...
I think I'm the only person here who's read the novella, but also quite a long time ago. I think that in the novella, you have the townsfolk and their commentary and their appearance, in some ways quite a gruesome appearance in the storyline. Whereas here, for reasons which we may have already discussed, they're completely taken away.
But then it becomes a stylistic reason as well. And I think it works. I mean, I'm going to vote for The Wind, because I think of the nature part of it, giving you that psychological isolation. And, of course, she triumphs over the isolation at the end, which I think is a nice thing. But I think the isolation in Lady Macbeth is really interesting because it is an isolation that is, at the end of the film, and we are going to talk about the ending, but at the end of the film, she is absolutely isolated. She has gone from being isolated by society and isolated by her situation, but, you know, in a loveless marriage or whatever, to then being the only person. And she has, you know, as she stares out at the screen at you, she has nowhere to go.
I'm going to go for Lady Macbeth, because I think it takes isolation as a vulnerability and turns it into isolation as a strength, whether that might be, you know, not perfect emotionally. But yeah, so I'm going to go for Lady Macbeth. And we're going to talk now about visual style in the films.
I've not actually seen very much else by Victor Sjöström. Or Victor Seastrom, as he seems to be called in this film. That's his American name.
Yeah, the Americanization of Sjöström.
I saw a film called The Outlaw and His Wife many years ago at university, and it also had that kind of sense of nature and so forth. But he has a lyrical style, I think, or a sort of suggestive style. There's a beauty to it. It felt like a very interior film, though, to me. And Lady Macbeth opens it out a little bit, obviously. I mean, there's the sense of these very fixed camera shots in the beginning, where she's facing off against her father-in-law or her husband, again, along tables, and there's just these sort of back and forth, these very formal, frontal, almost portrait-type style painterly, I hate that word, but
I really like that word, actually, if it's any consolation.
It's just I've seen the film Barry Lyndon so often, and that word is it's a blight against all criticism.
That's more like paintingly rather than painterly.
Painterly isn't quite right, but that sort of frontal camera that doesn't move in or out, or just looks at the tableau, and there are these scenes with that are like that. But then as soon as she has the sort of these emotional encounters, especially when she gets outside and goes to meet Sebastian and so forth, it becomes much more fluid and much more
handheld,
and there's more of a sense of tactility to it. And I like that. I found that fascinating, and it makes me want to go back and watch it again and like pick up on more of that.
Yeah, I mean, I really like the sort of cutaways from those sort of very composed shots you were talking about to Celine the Moor, and I feel like is it the Moor in Northumberland?
I don't know. Is it?
I liked those composed shots in Lady Macbeth, because when I watched the film the first time, I'm going to say, because hopefully I'll watch it again. When I watched the film at first, you know, you sort of see her in this very constricted role, and you see her being winched into her corsets and so on, and she's in these very symmetrical compositions, and you sort of feel that's kind of an oppressive thing for her. But when you realise, actually, the whole time, she's trying to manipulate herself to be the centre of the household. Mm-hmm. So actually, she wants to be. So when she sits down at the end of the film, I don't call this a spoiler, when she sits on the sofa at the end of the film, you know, you see she's perfectly composed again, and that's the place she wants.
One of the shots Lady Macbeth goes back to is this sofa shot. Because we come back to that shot about four or five times in the film, there is a development in that very last version of the shot. She is pale. Mm. She is drawn. She is pregnant. But you can't tell that from the shot necessarily. But there is it's the first time you kind of see an almost haunted look in her eye as well. Mm. Previously, she's bored. She is trapped. She is presenting herself. And the recreation of this scene over and over again just gives the film this wonderful sense of, I mean, you use the word symmetry, and that's exactly what it is. It brings the symmetry of the composition into the, this is just going to go round and round and round, this slow descent of this woman's situation. She ends up in a much worse situation, but one that she controls. On the Wind side, I agree with you up to a point, but I think there are, the film starts with a lot of, in the first sort of 20 minutes of the film is either in the train or the exteriors of the train or the being picked up on the horses. So it goes from being very external to then becoming very internal. And again, that mirrors her hope, almost, that the hope of the world, I think, ends up in this small shack where terrible things may and do happen. And of course, at the end of it, she comes to terms with it by embracing the wind, by embracing the external again, which we don't see, she just says. And so he brings that in really nicely, I think.
Yeah. One of the things I think interesting talking about style in The Wind and in relation to Lady Macbeth, and it isn't always easy to make sort of pat connections, but Lady Macbeth is a film, and a lot of people, when it first shown at the festivals and things, described it as a kind of horror film and talked about bloodbaths and things like that. There's no bloodbath.
No.
There's the horror is psychological, takes all the kind of horror out of the novella, but, you know, horrid things happen. But by and large, it doesn't have what you would call any kind of horror imagery. Now, I hate talking about genre with silent film, because obviously horror wasn't a genre in the silent era, but actually The Wind has things that look a little bit like horror imagery. Mm. The superimposed horses and the real grotesque shot in The Wind, the horror shot, which does make you think of Lady Macbeth, is the body being uncovered by the sand. And that's really powerful stuff. We all sort of gasped, didn't we?
Yeah. Whereas Lady Macbeth is toying with, I mean, I think it's metatextual about period films. And I think you brought up Andrea Arnold's Wuthering Heights. And I think it uses that in some ways as a bit of shorthand.
So when it comes to visual style, I mean, we're talking about MGM spending squillions and having, you know, a very, very accomplished and experienced director. And then we're talking about William Oldroyd's debut feature. It's got shot for very little money, but obviously with like what we might expect would be greater technology.
Mm.
So, you know, maybe the imbalance between the two films evens itself out a little bit here.
Well, I just want to say, I feel like I've seen a number of films that are shot on a small budget that don't they look it. Frankly, I did not pick Lady Macbeth as being a particularly strained production, but it looks great. I think it feels great. And it's very carefully composed and stylized without being fussy or too bound up in the kind of the usual period kind of stuff. But I think it looks great, and I would vote for the Lady Macbeth on this category.
Vote for the Lady Macbeth. I like that. I like the use of the definite article there. How about you, Peter?
I'm going to go for Lady Macbeth. I think that there are just some really clever, really smart things done. And the visual style is a character, is a part of the film almost. It's sort of, you know, again, because she's such a closed character in some ways, the fact that the film can take us so far into her story and give her sympathy before it really goes, I think is all part of the style and all part of the visual style. And I think how it plays with the history of those kind of films, I think is really important and has learnt and still innovates.
Excellent. Well, it's good that we have two votes for Lady Macbeth, because did I tell you that my votes count double? No, that's not true at all. But I am actually going to go for The Wind, because much as I agree with everything you say about Lady Macbeth, and I think it's excellent, and everyone involved, the costume department, the designers, everyone should be commended highly. The Wind actually made me gasp at the beauty of it sometimes. There were certain scenes, the train sequence. I remember, I think we were watching it, I was sort of going, can we just watch that again? So The Wind made me sort of forget myself and clutch my pearls and cry out with the pleasure of it. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go for The Wind.
Excellent.
Fair enough.
So the next category is, we're going to talk about suspense, but we could sort of broaden it out to talk about violence, something if you would like to.
I mean, I just talked a little bit about the suspense of the Letty's wedding night. She's been forced into getting married to Liege. Her original choice of partner turned out to be less suitable. Already married, and as we'll find out later, a rapist too. She knows what's going to happen when she gets home. She knows what's expected of her.
She's scared of it.
And he comes on strong, and it all goes a bit. It feels like it's going to go somewhere where it doesn't go.
There's almost the sort of Angel Clare, the kind of you know, the Lady Macbeth thing of, you know, what's worse than a husband who forces his attentions on you, one who doesn't want you at all.
Yes, exactly. You know. So the film plays with suspense there massively. Latterly, we have probably the most suspenseful aspects of The Wind, which is the rape sequence, non-sequence, and then the post-rape sequence where she is told basically she should go off with him because she is now sullied goods, and so therefore her husband won't want her, and he's the only hope for her, and she, spoilers, shoots him.
If you've seen the still of Lillian Gish with the gun, which is one of the greatest stills ever, then you might not be surprised that somebody is going to go underneath the patio at some point.
But again, is played with the idea that Lillian Gish is a weak woman who cannot do something. And whilst the film toys a little bit with the idea that the gun goes off by accident, I don't buy
she
that.
She wants it to happen
and it happens.
But enough about Elle.
Yes. Sorry, yes. So I think with The Wind, the suspense is built up very much from dealing with tropes which people will be well aware of, and then subverting them in some cases and using them to the full in other cases. And I think there is plenty of suspense. And of course, the very last bit of suspense is when her husband comes home, what is going to happen, which we will come on to.
Well, that's what we always worry about all day. What do you think about Lady Macbeth and suspense?
Well, my feeling about both films was I just wondered how much suspense there was. Because in Lady Macbeth, right from the title, you feel like you know there's a tragic overtone. You know how this is going to go. She's one of these characters like Medea that just sort of is going to sweep away everything in her path. And when you see her, okay, she starts as a sort of coward and fragile character, literally naked, being ordered around by her husband. And you think, well, is she really a Lady Macbeth? But then she sort of starts to exert power throughout the film, and she uses it more and more where she can against the servants, who are all noticeably people of colour in many cases. So there's a sort of racial dynamic there too, which is kind of nasty as well. It feels like a film where the tragedy is foretold from the very start, from the title, from before you've even seen it. And with the Wind, I'm also wondering, there's a constant sense of unhappiness or incipient tragedy to everything that happens. There's no sense that these are good ideas and these are all going to go well and everything's going to go swimmingly. I guess it does interesting things, and it certainly, as you said, Pete, does things that maybe you don't entirely expect from the way that they're set up. But in terms of where things go at the end, it has the same foreboding sense of the kind of classic kind of Russian tragic ending that they would put on for the Eastern market.
I'm really glad you used the word foreboding, because I think that's a wicked word. There's definitely foreboding in both of them. I think it's more that than suspense in a way.
Yep.
There's a sense of, you know, these are women who are in oppressive situations, and are they going to become victims? There's a certain sort of queasy horror anticipation of thinking, but would it be worse, actually? Can we handle it if they don't become victims? Because we understand that dynamic. But, you know, Lillingish starts killing people, you know, then chaos comes. And, you know, Catherine's behaviour is absolutely wild. You say you didn't really like her. You sympathise with her plight. But, you know, to gain any kind of upper footing, she has to do vile things. And, you know, she has absolutely no morality. Foreshadowing is very strong in both of them. But I think with both films, you are just rocketing through them thinking, what is going to happen at the end? How is this terrible situation going to be alleviated in any way?
How bad is it going to end up being for everyone? And, you know,
I mean, I'm quite squeamish, and I got sent to review The Lady Macbeth, as we're going to call it now, right? And having read the novella a bit beforehand, I was like, they are sending me to a horror film. Yeah, I was scared, but in a very different way. I wasn't thinking, you know, what gruesome sights am I going to see? Although, can we say, the violence in Lady Macbeth, I think the way it's handled is largely excellent. It's very restrained, but the sound effects involved with the violence.
Yeah, sound is very important to it, because obviously it can't show so much. You know, its special effects budget is tiny, so its one gory moment is straight out of, you know, the kit you could buy when you were a kid, horror makeup, which is great because it works.
And the most disturbing murder, and actually I've got no need to spoil this, I don't think it's because of it, they just don't want to show that happening on screen. I mean, she does something that is beyond the pale.
Yeah,
her body
really
is blocking the view. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you see the thrashing of the legs, but you see that under.
There's some violence to animals as well. That's pretty.
Didn't like the horse being shot.
Not. No, I did not.
And that's fine.
That
you're
was
right.
Quite a shocking moment.
That was the moment when you completely turned off her. Is that right?
I certainly started turning there, but although afterwards I thought maybe that wasn't really fair of me, but just in a being there in the moment, that's how I felt. I was, okay.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that's the most shocking thing she does. We do have two vegans at the table here, so we'll do our vegan film reviews where we...
Are we going to talk about Raw next?
I mean, one of the things that she does is she pushes herself to the top, and she doesn't take anyone with her. So shooting the horse is kind of quite a good illustration of the way that she basically shits on everyone beneath her. So she distances herself from Sebastian, to be honest, but definitely Anna. I mean, she stands by while Anna is humiliated in the most horrendous way.
She feels like she passes down the abuse that she's getting from above, or the patriarchal kind of constraint she's getting, and passes it to the people that she can. And that's what's brutal, I think.
And to the extent of letting other people take the punishment for her own crimes. So if you're talking about grisliness and horror and violence, then much as I'd like to make a case for Victor Ostrom's The Wind because it's so powerful psychologically, I'm going to vote for Lady Macbeth on the score of doom and violence and crime and nastiness.
If that's what we're scoring it on, Doom and Violence and Crime and Nastiness, then yeah, Lady Macbeth gets it all the way. I do think that The Wind does manage to maintain a lot more suspense than I expected. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think Lady Macbeth has it on that one.
I would third that. That was my my choice for this category as well.
Jesus, so forgive me.
I'd rather stop you breathe than have you doubt how I feel.
So our final category, we're going to talk about the endings of the films. So I've not read the Dorothy Scarborough novel. I have, a long time ago, read the Nikolai Leskov novella. And so I was taken aback by the ending of Lady Macbeth. This is not a spoiler, but it finishes at a different point to the novella, shall we say.
Yes.
The famous quote about, you know, if you want a happy ending, that just depends on where you
stop the film.
Yeah, stop the story. Yeah. And famously, though it's much contested, the story goes that on The Wind, they shot both the original ending of the novel, which mm-hmm. ends up with the character walking out into the wind alone.
Mm-hmm. Being driven mad.
Yeah, mad and guilty and full of horrors. And instead, but they decided against it, even though Lillian Gish liked it. The ending that we now have is, however it came about, is a kind of happy ending where she embraces mm-hmm. the wind and her marriage and starts a new life on the frontier.
I don't read it that way. I think she's destroyed by the wind. I think she goes out there to basically, it's a fatalistic gesture, and she throws herself on its mercy. I don't think it's happy at all. I mean, it's happy. Yeah. I think it's happy within the context of the film. I think it's
as happy as it
can
be.
It's how her character approaches it. But yeah. I think that's a sign of her character giving up and just and being destroyed. That's what I see that as. So I think that's her end.
So you think marriage is worse than dying alone on the prairie?
Tell me, you're the married people in the room, so not to each other.
Imagine two vegans being married to each other.
That's madness.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is the thing, it's interesting because, you know, does she have a moral... Is there any reason why she should not want to be married to Lars Hansen and living happily and raising children and keeping the house clean? What is so wrong about that? I mean, has she asserted any wish for a different kind of life? I would like to marry Lars Hansen. Have I made this clear?
Lars Hansen doesn't speak any English, apparently. Yeah.
Even
so
better.
Silent.
Strong but silent.
Talk to each other with our eyes.
So I'll let you muse that. I'm more with Pam in the universe of the film. I think that she is happy. I mean,
a comedy is defined by marriage at the end, right?
Yeah, I guess.
If we're going back to Shakespeare.
If we are, yes, that's true. I mean, I do think that both of these have to be also seen within their periods that they're set and what is a happy ending. I mean, one of the changes in Lady Macbeth from the source material is that the young master that comes into the house is a illegitimate child or a son, her husband's son. The issue the film is always going to have is that women couldn't inherit property at that point. From Catherine's point of view, Lady Macbeth, people shouldn't be able to discover her husband's dead because then the jig is up, sort of. So when the film ends, she is sitting on that couch, as we've said. She is staring out at the audience. She is in control. She is in power, but she's not really. She's got that for, I'd say, a couple of months at best. And then beyond that, who knows? But she hasn't got anyone on her side anymore. And so maybe take this moment. But that's not the actual ending of the film. So the actual ending of the film is every time you see that poster. Because the poster is everywhere on the tube for Lady Macbeth, and it is of her sitting there on that couch. And when we were speaking about...
The one of her standing there with the chair?
No, it's the one of her sitting on the couch. And Ewan said to me last night that the film had been hanging with him for a few days. He wasn't sure when he first saw it, but it really stayed with him. And I think that's what, that once you've seen it, it doesn't leave you because it's following you around the tube and it's there.
I feel the same way about the poster for Raw. That the look of the young lady with the blood. It's just like, it's got the same kind of intensity and it follows you.
But it does.
I can guarantee that Lady Macbeth will stay with you if the posters are not there. I mean, I think this is one thing that's interesting. If we had seen at the end of The Wind, Lillian Gish walking into the wind, you feel like the word wind comes up so often, there'd be a sort of openness to the ending, which would make it so much more haunting, and this is troubling, and this is why Hollywood didn't like endings like that. Whereas there is a certain openness to Lady Macbeth, the idea of Lady Macbeth is one, people are just, you know, relatively minor character who people are constantly fascinated by. She troubles people, and this film sort of explores, you know, what if a woman gave in to her Lady Macbeth side And
the question about the shooting of The Wind's Ending, I think, is a little bit moot because a shot of her walking into the wind could be easily picked up from any aspects of the film. The interesting thing, of course, is that there is the section where basically the body vanishes, you know, gets taken away by the wind, and it's suggested that the wind will wipe away, you know, things which are, you know, are just and good, or, you know, which
then, of course, the evidence of a crime if the crime is justified. Indeed, yeah.
And also, but also suggests that there is an aspect of it is, did it happen at all? Is she mad? Is that there? And if she is mad, then I think, you know, the happy ending is sort of saying, well, she's come to terms of madness, or it's not completely closed, the ending of The Wind, but it's more closed than the ending of the book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, the ending of Lady Macbeth is less close than the ending of the book.
Yeah.
Feel we might be coming to a natural ending of our own.
In which case, we should probably score the endings.
We should probably score. So we've got two endings of two films that were changed from two books. Mm-hmm. We've got lots to think about. Ewan?
I will go for The Wind. I mean, I understand that it's perhaps different from what it was intended to be, but I don't know. For me, it feels right. It feels like a great way to end that film. Lady Macbeth will stick with me, and I'm sure it has that kind of open ending that is so popular, or has been so popular recently, that kind of open-ended kind of what fill in the blanks kind of thing. It will stay with me, and it has stayed with me, but The Wind, yeah,
absolutely great. And
I love a happy ending. I'm going for The Wind.
Forget that, I'm going for Lady Macbeth. Yeah, I'm going for Lady Macbeth. Yes. I think that there's something really strong about that troubling ending in a film that has many troubling issues. Now you guys can sing a song, write some limericks while I do some songs.
I would like to apologise for the last podcast, where on a number of occasions I called François Villon, the poet, François Fillon, who was, of course, one of the
presidential
candidates. And I do hope this didn't hurt his run, though obviously he didn't make it down to the last two.
So, this is where we need to insert the drum roll sound effect. Who do you think's won, guys? What's your gut feeling?
I think The Wind has won.
I feel like if we were marking it on which is the greater film, the Wind should win.
Possibly The Wind is the greater film, but today we have voted 8 to The Wind and 10 to Lady Macbeth.
Wow.
This is good news. They're both great films.
They are both great films. And
that's,
you know, I think
more or less a tie.
And I think, you know, with the power of this podcast, the leg up that we can give Lady Macbeth, which only opened in cinemas yesterday, is probably right and good. And particularly as you can't get hold of The Wind easily.
Yeah. Thank you so much for listening to The Sound Barrier. Lady Macbeth is out now in cinemas. The Wind, as we've said, is slightly harder to see, so we watched it on French DVD release, and we'd all absolutely love to see a proper home video release for this film. It's a real classic and highly recommended. The Sound Barrier is presented in association with SOAS Radio, so thanks to them, and thanks to Ewan for joining us this time. Do check out his reviews on filmcentric.wordpress.com.
Thank you for the plug.
Thank you very much for being here. And thank you to Pete, of course.
Ooh, always a pleasure, never a chore.
For me, this is nothing but a chore. If you have any suggestions for films we could match up, then please do let us know in the comments on silentlondon.co.uk.
Otherwise, it is definitely going to be Rescue by Rover versus A Dog's Purpose.
None of us want that. Or tweet us at Silent London. You can find more episodes of the Silent London podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. The next episode of The Sound Barrier will be with you in a fortnight, and we'll be announcing the films for that installment soon if you'd like to watch what we're watching. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.